You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Hi there, I'm Dean Olsher, filling in today for Leonard Lopate. The instruction was simple: make somebody up. So writes Zadie Smith in her introduction to a new anthology that she's edited. It's called The Book of Other People. A total of 23 authors, including herself, took the challenge for free. It's a benefit for 826 NYC, and we'll discuss what that is later on. Zadie Smith is here, along with two of her fellow fiction writers who appear in the book, George Saunders and Venda Levita, and we're very lucky to have all of you here today. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you.
So Zadie Smith, you write also in the same introduction that the book has no particular thesis or argument to convey about fictional character, but I wonder maybe if there isn't one that's sort of implied that emerges on its own, and that is in this era that we live in when the New York Times book review will maybe devote four book reviews to fiction or novels and then the rest of it to generally nonfiction, often memoirs where people recount stories of one's own self. It seems to be here staking a claim on behalf of, you know, good old-fashioned character-driven works of the imagination. Am I right?
Yeah, I mean, that might be true of me. I have a sympathy for that kind of fiction, but I also wanted to leave it as open as possible for people who, for instance, as George did, took it in a completely other direction and gave us a puppy, or yes, my friend Toby Litt, who gave us a monster.
Puppies are people too.
Puppies are people too, definitely in George's mind. But I just felt that I wanted to show a way of character which is a little more detailed than maybe you would find, say, in a New Yorker piece of nonfiction. The description of a person is four lines. You know, he has sandy red hair. Yes. He has a certain thing with his mouth. It's always the same over and over again.
Right.
And there is a possibility of fiction to do something much more detailed and nuanced when creating character, and it's nice not to forget that.
Say more about that. When you think about the contemporary fiction that gets most people's attention, are you saying that it's not as character-driven?
No, I don't particularly. I mean, I suppose I write that kind of thing, but my tastes are much broader than what I write. I write what I just can't help but write, but yeah, I like to read fiction on a broader basis. So really the principle was just to give something that was as free as possible, and it was the freest thing I could think of.
There were no other constraints, were there?
No, none at all. And right, often when I'm asked to do anthologies, I'll get asked to do something like write a story on the theme of, I don't know, being mixed raced, or anything like that goes to the back of my inbox and I never look at it again. So I wanted to try and avoid giving any specific instructions, because I know how writers react to them, usually with horror.
Yes, well, as they should. That's their job, right?
Yeah.
So George Saunders, it's so hard to figure out how to talk about a work of fiction, because you don't want to say this is about X or Y. It's so much bigger than that. So I'm going to leave it up to you to present what your story is.
Well, basically, we were driving around in upstate New York many years ago, and we sort of flew by this house, and there was a little sign in front that said puppies for sale. And then in the backyard, there was this shocking thing of a little boy about 6 years old with a harness chained to a tree.
Mm-hmm.
And
sort of like that Mike Myers character on Saturday Night Live.
Exactly.
And
so we just, you know, that was it. We just sort of flew by it and I took note of it. And then had a little fragment of that sort of lying around. And then in the way that, you know, I think fiction works, you don't really know why it's interesting. And I guess at some level, you're trying to figure out what's going on there. Who
yes,
did that? How? Why would someone do that? And then
yes,
beyond that, I think it just kind of grows outward. You know, you keep trying to answer your own questions in a certain way.
So what you've done here is it becomes a story of a puppy adoption.
Right.
And a tale of two cities.
Right.
Of sorts.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what I love about this kind of assignment is that it keeps leading you deeper and deeper into the question of what does fiction do that nothing else can.
Mm.
So, you know, in a very image film-based society, where even our high art now is often visual,
yes,
this is the one place where I can do that insane thing of saying, I'm going to pretend I'm you. I'm going to pretend I could ever know what's going on in your mind.
Mm.
Now, the truth is you can't even convey what's going on in your own mind in prose. I mean, you literally, if I walk from here to the bathroom
yeah,
and try to notate what happened, it's impossible.
Yeah.
So it's a kind of a nervy thing to do, but I think it also is such an empathy-building thing.
Empathy is the word that was coming to mind, yes.
To say, even if you're the woman who chained her kid to a tree, I could inhabit and even maybe love you. That,
right.
That's the sort of radical thing about
yes,
fiction.
Try to suspend judgment, which
right,
is what Milan Kundera says. However, I talked to Cynthia Ozick about this once, and she said, absolutely not. Fiction is all about the settling of scores. She had nothing to do with suspending judgment. Forget it. Anybody here in agreement with her?
No. There's a bit of truth in it. I do think that writers like to think of themselves as massively empathetic creatures. I like to think of myself that way. But certainly, if you're always... It's always your... It's through your eyes, it's your viewpoint, and there's always a hand on the scale. Mm. And the skill is supposedly to try and hide the hand on the scale as much as possible.
Yeah.
Some of us do it better than others, and some of us don't wish to.
Russell, I think empathy actually, maybe attention is for me, a more interesting word, because you certainly should be able to portray somebody doing a horrible thing.
Mm.
And if you pay close enough attention, there's that magic moment where what looks like horror to you suddenly starts to make sense.
Mm.
You know, to the person who does the horrible thing, I don't think a person often is saying, yeah, today's my day to be horrible. I think usually they're coming at it the other way, and they're saying, well, it's going to be a great day when I eliminate all those Tootsies. Mm. Woohoo!
Mm.
You know, so that, to me, that's the magic moment in fiction where empathy and attention become the same thing.
So become someone else. Put yourself in the mind of someone else rather than saying, this happened to me and this is how it made me feel.
Right. Although you can never put yourself in the mind of someone else. You can only put yourself in your own mind, sort of doing it on person.
Yes.
Right. Vinda Levita, I'm going to do the same for you. I don't want to try to say what your story is about. You do that for me.
I'll talk about how it started. When I got Zadie's email inviting me to be part of the anthology, it happened to come to my inbox on a day when I was thinking a lot about a type of person I knew when I was younger, and that was kind of the wayward and often uninvited and unwelcome house guest, of which we had many when I was growing up. My mother came to this country from Sweden as an au pair, and as having done that, she felt it was her unofficial role to kind of foster Swedish au pairs to come to San Francisco as well. And so she, this is going somewhere, don't worry. and so she kind of became this unofficial liaison between au pairs in Sweden and families in San Francisco. And they would come over, these girls, usually from the country, and within a matter of a few months, they usually would end up back at our house because they would have done something to piss off the to upset the families.
Don't go any further.
Yes. They would, you know, something would happen, like the wife would fall in love with the au pair, or the au pair would be found doing something in the kitchen pantry with somebody's cousin or whatever it was. And so they would end up on our doorstep and then have to stay with us for a couple of months. And I was thinking about this kind of person and that type of person who, as a young girl growing up in San Francisco, I was really excited every time this happened because it meant they got to sleep in my room and got to dress me up and, you know, show me the way. And then there was always a period of disenchantment after a few weeks. And so the character in my story, Soleil, in the anthology is...
That's spelled based, S-O-L-E-I-L,
yes.
As in the French word for Soleil,
yes,
her son.
It's kind of based on this type of person who would insinuate herself into our lives. And in the story, it's about a young girl named Gabrielle who becomes infatuated with one of these types of women until she takes her on a trip that kind of goes awry.
Yeah. So the two very different takes on the assignment.
Yes.
That's Vinda Levita. We heard from George Saunders and also Zadie Smith. They are all here. They're all here to talk about The Book of Other People, which Zadie Smith edited. It's published by Penguin. And so here's very two different ways of reacting to the assignment. There are 23 in all. Zadie Smith, did the exercise in itself teach you anything new about the possibilities of fiction?
Well, for me, I always think of myself as more of a reader than a writer anyway. So just personally, it was a thrill to get all these stories by writers that I admire, some writers that I've admired since I was a teenager, in my inbox, and to see the process of a story being refined. Because often you get a first draft, and a classic writer response to sending emailing the first draft is to send the second draft 2 minutes later, then the third draft, then the fourth. Don't read this one, read the other one. No, don't read this one. That goes on all day. So it was nice to see people doing that exactly the way I do it.
And did you do back and forth with them and suggest changes?
Well, it was interesting because, A, you're asking people to work for no money, which is not the easiest thing in the world. B, sometimes you're asking people older than you, far more superior than you, to work for no money and then to submit to your editing, which is a little bit much to take. So I kind of applied a policy. I recommend it to other anthology editors where if someone gives you something and you think maybe it needs an extra polish, you just say, oh, this is really nice, but you know, Y sent me a really great story today. Y did really well. And then X takes back their story immediately, redoes it.
I'm trying to think if I got that letter or not.
You just play them off against each other, and in the end, you have perfection.
And do you send them Y's story?
No, switching of stories. Yeah. Just suggest, oh, yeah, but, you know, I got three good stories today, and then everybody just lifts their game, because writers are so competitive.
A friend of mine got a job at The Daily Show.
Yeah.
A friend of mine had that happen to him. He got a job at The Daily Show as a writer. His first day there, Stephen Colbert walked in when he was a correspondent. He said, he was there with another new writer. He says, I heard one of you is really funny. And he walked out of the room.
Wow.
It's the way to do it. Yeah. So I did a bit of that, and then I did very light editing, but mainly it depends. With someone you know very well, like a friend of mine, Adam Thirlwell, who's in the book, who we read each other's work all the time anyway. Mm. So that's a very interesting and easy editorial relationship, because I can say anything to him, he can say anything to me, we can edit easily. But I think it depends on who the writer is and what they feel comfortable with. And mostly they didn't really need that much work. These are all pretty great writers,
I'll say.
Yeah.
I look at this list from the point of view of a reader. It makes you think, oh, these people are all pals with each other, and there's this community of writers that exists around the world. Is that a fantasy?
No, it's mixed. Some of these people I really hardly know at all or have never met. The others I do know well. I think the difference is, like, if you talk to a generation of writers, like 20 years before us, there's a lot, obviously, of fear and dread and loathing. I think email has changed that a bit, because yeah, even as you're beginning to fear and dread and loathe the person on the other side of the world, you can email them, you can have, you know, your fears can be slightly softened by a more intimate contact. And obviously the festivals as well mean you meet each other once or twice a year. But I think, I mean, for a project like this, you have to have communication. But I don't know.
But maybe not community?
Most of these people live on the other side of the world from me, so it's hard to have a tight community. But it's very nice to feel that there are people you can talk to about what is, after all, quite a strangely isolating job.
Of course, of course. Vinda Levita, I'm going to ask you, what is 826 NYC?
826 NYC is related to, started with 826 Valencia, which is based in San Francisco, where I live. And I was one of the inaugural board members and founding members of 826 San Francisco. And it's kind of a funny name, because obviously in San Francisco, 826 Valencia refers to the address, whereas in 826 Brooklyn, it just means 826.
Completely
different. And basically, the objective of 826 is everywhere. There are now 7 of them across the country, is to provide one-on-one writing assistance to students ages 8 through 18, and in particular to help teachers who are now having, you know, overflowing classrooms really get to give one-on-one attention to students with their writing. And that can come in any forms, helping them with college admission as essays, helping them just with their grammar, helping them form a story, helping them write a song.
Filling a void in our educational system?
Yes, filling a void is a popular popular phrase that is often associated with 826 Valencia and 826 NYC. And what's interesting about 826 NYC, I was just there this morning, is that they do a lot of different things. They have drop-in tutoring, free drop-in tutoring every day at the center, and that about 40 kids drop in every day, sometimes more. They go into schools to provide one-on-one tutoring if the teachers invite them in. They don't just show up. They get invited by the teachers to come in to work on projects. They also have workshops in the evening. There are two going on right now. One is called Gotta Write to Sing the Blues, which is helping kids write blues songs. We figured out early on that the titles of these courses are really important. Originally, there was a workshop offered in San Francisco called Radio 101, and nobody signed up. But then they changed the title to You on the Radio. And there were like 50 signups overnight. The other workshop that's going on right now at 826 NYC is called Molding the Story, How to Breathe Life into Clay, which is basically a chance to make a short claymation film. So those are two things that are going on there now.
826 NYC is the beneficiary of this book, The Book of Other People, which we're discussing today on the Leonard Lopate Show. Three of the participants are here today, George Saunders, Vinda Levita, and Zadie Smith, the editor. And the book is out by Penguin. We're going to take a little break right now and be back with them in just a moment. This is the Leonard Lopate Show, and I'm Dean Olscher sitting in today. And what a treat to have three terrific writers all in the same room at the same time. Are you guys allowed to fly together? I mean, isn't it sort of like the president, the vice president, Secretary of State?
We fly together every week. That's why we can't get any work done.
That's George Saunders, Vinda Levita, and also Zadie Smith, who is the editor of this collection called The Book of Other People. It's out by Penguin, from Penguin, and it's, as we mentioned, a benefit for 826 NYC. 23 different characters. The assignment was make somebody up, and everybody did. And then I also, before we get too far into this conversation, want to talk to some ghosts who hover over your work. One in particular who passed in the last year, Kurt Vonnegut, I know was a particular influence of yours, George Saunders. Yeah. Why? What was it about him that steered you?
Well, I think what happened with, me was I was from a kind of a working class background, and I was a big Hemingway. I had what's called a Hemingway boner. It's kind of a technical term we us writers use. And I thought the whole purpose of fiction was to experience something and then turn around and then replicate it, so the reader would feel exactly the same thing you felt. Which,
yes.
of course, is impossible.
Yes.
And then I think just reading Vonnegut, I realized that that's not the point at all. The point is to have something happen. You know, and you don't know what it is. So, in other words, what you're trying to do is reach down and take your reader and just fling them some distance and some vector. And it's actually the flight that they enjoy. And I don't think it really even matters how you do it or where they end up or if there's a moral, ethical updraft. It's just, it's literally the feeling of being sucked into a text and then being thrown some distance. And when I read Slaughterhouse-Five, which I had thought was going to be this big sort of Hemingway-esque war novel, that happened to me. That was really empowering to realize you don't have to know what you're doing. You don't have to know what you're going to do to the reader. You just have to do something by any means necessary. So even now, when I get in a little bit of backslide to that Hemingway-esque mode, I just go read a little Vonnegut.
You know, I was having trouble sort of describing your stories because more and more I find myself wanting to resist the question, what is it about? And try to get at a more interesting question. I still don't know how to phrase it. Maybe you can help me. Something along the lines of, what kind of experience does it create for the end user?
Right.
I don't know if there's a better way to ask that question. Maybe you have an idea, Venda Levita.
I don't know if there's a better way to ask that question. I'm not one of these people who thinks that stories are mystical things. But I do think what was interesting about this assignment, is it an assignment?
Why not, right?
It felt like an assignment.
It felt like an assignment. Something we had to turn in. She had a deadline. Is that it really forced me personally to think about stories as being dictated by characters. I usually start writing novels with a place in mind, and then the plot becomes important, and then the character is important. Or the plot and the character emerge simultaneously. Mm. But I always start with an idea of a place. And for me, what was interesting about this assignment was starting with the character and really taking that expression, that character is plot, and kind of figuring out what that meant. And because I started with this idea of this character, Soleil, who comes to visit this girl, and let the character dictate the plot.
Now, that does seem completely spiritual and flaky and weird, but I hear writers say that all the time, you know, that the character has told the story to them. And I say, come on. But it is true, right?
Well, you just think, what would this character, once you get an idea of what the character, who the character is, you just think, okay, what would this character wear? And that might take the plot in a different direction. What would this character do for a living? And that dictates what kind of car she drives. And it kind of...
How do you get to that place? How do you unlock the part of your mind that says, okay, this is what I'm going to do, and then go instead in the direction of saying, I'm going to listen to that voice inside?
You don't really think about it. You just think, Zadie said this story last week, and then you write...
My story has a lot of, it's two characters, and it's done with mostly inner monologue. And what I find is it's all language-based. You start typing in a certain diction.
And a voice.
And a voice. And really, I think at some level, it has something to do with sentence rhythms and authenticity. And then there is that moment where you blurt something out in that character's voice that you didn't know about.
Right.
And suddenly, that becomes plot. Because if suddenly you find out that the person has a big goiter on their forehead, well, I didn't know that, but the phrase popped out. Okay, so therefore that inflects everything that came before and everything that's going to come after has that goiter hanging over it, so to speak. So, so for me, I'm kind of a lyric guy, but I think what I found when I was a young writer is I tried to figure out stories from the before I even started, make sure they were charged with thematic content and all this, and that it's very paralyzing. But if you start with a sentence and you try to do something to make the sentence more pleasing to you, often plot is what you inadvertently blurt out.
Yes. That's George Saunders, Venda Levita, and also Zadie Smith here. It's The Book of Other People. It's published by Penguin, and I'm Dean Ulsher filling in for Leonard Lopate here today. Zadie Smith, your story. I'm going to ask you to sort of tell what happens in your story, if you don't mind.
No, absolutely.
There's a plot twist, if you don't mind revealing. I don't know. I find it enigmatic, and I want to know the answer to the question, who is telling the story?
This Hanwell, I started writing these series of Hanwell stories. My father died last year, and he was obviously a smith, and the more I found out about him just before he died and as he died, the more incredibly undistinguished my family appeared to me, going back almost 2,000 years of smith, 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 nothing ever happened, we never did anything. And of course nobody ever wrote about us or bothered thinking about us. I mean, really, the the backbone of English life, just the featureless, or so it seemed to me. So I, when I was doing the Hanwell stories, I really wanted to do something which, if you'd asked me 5 years ago, I would have thought of as, you know, incredibly retrograde and dull idea of kind of rescuing a family history. You know, I never thought of myself as the kind of writer who would write something like that. So I would write something for really personal therapeutic reasons, which which those stories absolutely are.
These are people from your ancestry.
The thing about my family is, because they were such low achievers, there really is no history to tell. They literally did nothing for hundreds of years. So it's about not just rescuing a history, but really making one up from the very few details I have of them. Like, your grandfather once had a chip van. This is the only thing I know about my grandfather. So from
a chip van, meaning that for us that means driving around and selling French fries to people.
In a van, selling French fries in the south of England for a while, but then it went wrong. This is all I know about his history. So it was about trying to kind of dig up these lives that are connected to mine. And even though for the people I'm talking about, I think if they had any knowledge of who I am, or my brothers and my half-sister, how strange we would be to them. It's basically that complete discontinuity in a family where there's no money or no particular direction. You know, other families have this great history. They pass it down one after the other. The thing about being from a very working-class family is the history ends every time someone dies. There's nothing to pass on. There's no stories to tell. It's just done.
The line from your narrator that sits with me still is, "I am often found making the statement, I don't believe in patterns."
Well, you know, yeah, I guess that's true. In when I first started writing, I was very opinionated about things that fiction things that fiction is and things that it isn't, and also what writing is and what writing is. And as you get older and you write, you're just continually humbled by the job that you do. It surprises you all the time. And one of the surprises for me was how much I need to write for quite personal reasons, which I completely didn't realize.
Mm-hmm. So you evoke this idea of resurrecting your own family's past to a certain degree, or doing what you can in that regard.
Yes.
What else?
Well, it was also for me an opportunity, because I'm usually found writing quite long novels that require a lot of continuity and a lot of, planning. It's nice for me to be able to write something small, completely independent, that doesn't have to push itself along. It's very hard when you're writing a novel to keep faith in the project, to keep faith that it's worth doing, that anybody gives a damn, that you give a damn. Because with a short story, you have a possibility of doing something that is just about pleasing to you and doesn't make you want to throw up on your shoes. And that's what I really, really...
That's a nice image.
Yeah, that's a really nice image.
Goiters and vomit.
But yeah, you have a possibility of doing something small which isn't totally horrible. Yeah. And I very rarely get that opportunity, so I really enjoy doing something small which isn't totally horrible. Basically.
What about the shrinking space given to fiction in the book review and other places? It's saddening to me that we seem to insist on stories pretending to be true, if not being true. And the idea that you make something up and that we give space to the truths that come from the imagination is marginalized. George Saunders?
Well, I think it's a shame. And I think it's actually a cause, in some complicated way, it's why we're having some of the problems we are. Because what fiction does is it reminds you, I mean, Zadie used the word humbling, reading it and writing it reminds you that you really can't know. You really don't know. And so whenever you act, you should act humbly, slowly, with your eyes wide open. And I think this reliance on fact-based stories gives you a false sense of knowing.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
And whereas fiction is constantly saying, maybe, maybe not, you know, and it urges you to be empathetic and slow.
Yes. No, there's no better way to learn that than to be a journalist and to cover the same story that 15 other people are covering and watch the Rashomon experience that happens.
That's right. Yeah.
You know?
But I also think if people are turning away from fiction, we also have to think about why that is. And I'm really drawn by nonfiction at the moment. And when George was talking about Vonnegut, I had a similar experience with Vonnegut. Before I read him, I was writing these very... or feeling that I had to write these very traditional, the way I'd been educated, basically English novels. And Vonnegut kind of breaks that open for you.
Yes, talk about liberation, right?
Complete liberation, and allows this looseness. And I do think that a lot of fiction these days is working inside its own genres so solidly that people do turn away from it. Mm. I can understand people turning away from it, because the way I have written novels in the past or felt that I had to, was to fulfill the model of what I believed a novel to be. Vonnegut just allows you to let go of your concept of what a novel is. And there needs to be a little bit more of that going around. Mm. There is a reason people are turning from fiction. They're a little bored, maybe.
Mm. Who is your ghost who hovers over your shoulder when you're writing?
It's me, isn't it?
It's mainly George.
Yeah. I try.
I tell him to leave the room. I think I had a very a fixed set of people that I've talked about a lot over the past 7 years, which is, again, basically my very traditional education. And people like Nabokov, people like Jane Austen and Ian Forster and
yes.
Tolstoy and et cetera, et cetera. And without these people, I could never write fiction. But for me, I really need a whole new set of ghosts. I think I don't want to move in the same 10 circles of these little gods that you have in your head and in your room. All I want to do now is read stuff as far as possible from those people. I've been reading a lot of Dennis Cooper, actually.
Huh.
He's my new ghost at the moment. I'm
so
a big fan.
What are you writing next?
I don't get my stuff out.
nothing, really, basically. I'm taking a little time out. I have a novel in mind, but I think you can try and write a novel every 2 years for the rest of your life. I think it's hard.
Sure.
Sometimes a little time out is a good plan.
Hear, hear.
And George, you also have your own life stuff as well.
What about you? What are you writing next?
Kind of the same. I have a little break, and I have a very ambitious kid's book from the point of view of a fox. And so the fun of that is he can't spell.
Oh, wow.
You have to shoot high. You know?
That sounds like Archie and Mehitabel.
Yeah,
So the flea who types.
Oh, yeah, I just realized. Maybe I'm ripping him off.
Well, I don't think so.
No, I'm not doing that fox book anymore.
Venda Levita, what's next for you?
I'm working on a novel set in Turkey. In the summer on a boat, and that's important to me because my last book was set in Lapland, in the very north of Scandinavia, but in the winter, and I had to go there a couple times to research it, so I decided that the next place I was going to set a novel was somewhere warm in the summer on the water.
You do lots of research.
Yes, exactly.
Venda Levita and George Saunders and Zadie Smith, it has been such a pleasure having you here today. They are participants in The Book of Other People, which has been published by Penguin and which is edited by Zadie Smith, and I thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.